Excuse me, it's afternoon.
But it's not very scientific of me to confuse the two of those. I'm Bruce Farrar. I am the Branch Services Administrator for the Public Library, and on behalf of Mayor Bill Purcell, the members of the Metropolitan Council, we of course want to welcome you to this lovely Metropolitan Government facility, and of course from Library Director Donna Nicely and the members of the Library Board, we also are delighted that you're here. We're also especially delighted, as always, to have our co-hosts and the people who provide the lunch, Vanderbilt University, with us. We could not do this without them because they are providing all the stuff. We are just providing the space. I understand we're talking about science today and science education. And from my background in having to train librarians to do things, they give you special train-the-trainer courses where you have to learn about adult education, and you are supposed to start off with a quiz of what everybody already knows, because adults, unlike children, already know it all. I think whoever wrote that book I read had not met my teenagers yet. That is not the case. So I prepared a quiz for you based on this authoritative work. Take me to your leader, science and math joke. Take me to your leader is what the Martians ask when they're on the metric system. Well, that was the problem. I tried this out in the on the speakers in the and they discouraged me from doing this and asking what a math teacher what you called a math teacher who had his head in the clouds. Pie in the sky, or letting loose the information that Henry VIII invented fractions, or that nitrates are cheaper than day rates. But I couldn't resist the question about where you get all the great books on plants and botany. At the branch libraries. All right, that's enough of that. I am happy now to introduce, and I'm sure you will all be relieved, the Assistant Director for Community, Neighborhood, and Government Relations for Vanderbilt University, Mary Pat Teague.
Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate always his comment. I sometimes think that we have this wonderful series and these very tremendous speakers, and with David Wood with his insightful questions and interactions with the speaker, but it'd almost be worth a trip down the library just to hear Bruce because of his wonderful wit and humor. And so, but fortunately, we're lucky that we have not only Bruce, but we do have David Wood to lead us and also wonderful speakers. But anyway, I'm here today to welcome you on behalf of Vanderbilt. Unfortunately, Mike Schoenfeld was unavailable to be here today, but he sends his greetings. And Betty Nixon also sends her greetings, and I noticed that she just snuck in the back of the room because she could not pass up a chance, I think, to hear Dr. Shepherd's talk, who is also a very good friend of hers. So anyway, it's my pleasure to be here today, and in their absence provides me this opportunity to welcome you. And on this beautiful first day of March, I'm fortunate to be here, and we presenting another dynamic speaker and topic. And so without further ado, I will introduce you to our leader of our philosophical conversation, Professor David Wood.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for your usual wit, and thank you, Mary Pat. It really is a great pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Virginia Shepherd. Dr. Shepherd is a woman of many parts, a distinguished research scientist, a fully engaged university citizen, and a champion, I think is the right word to use, of science education. As a research scientist, she holds appointments in medicine, pathology, and biochemistry, and she's done important work on how our lungs protect themselves against infection. As a university citizen at Vanderbilt, Ginny has participated widely in all kinds of faculty governance issues, and she served as president of our faculty senate. So But her current position as director of Vanderbilt Center for Science Education is really what brings her here today to talk to us about science education in the 21st century. I keep thinking that's like the next century, but it's this one, isn't it? We're in it already. Virginia Shepherd received her PhD from the University of Iowa, and after short stints at WashU and then UT Memphis, she came to Vanderbilt as research professor in 1988. In about 1990, she was bitten by the science education bug, and she spent the last 15 years working in various ways, on top of all her other commitments, to promote science education beyond Vanderbilt, in Nashville, and on the national stage, for example, leading efforts to reform intercollegiate athletics. She's been recognized for this work by numerous awards and honors, the Bruce Alberts Award for Outstanding Contributions of Science Education in 2000, and most recently, our own Metro School Board's recognition for her work in K-12 science education. In between, she's picked up the Medical Center's Outstanding Teaching Award and Vanderbilt's Alexander Hurd Distinguished Service Professor Award. It's clear that, as well as being an active scientist, she's also a great communicator and promoter of the cause of science education. I know I'd love to attend her honors seminar on Nobel Prize winners in science, and which she co-teaches with her husband, the physicist Charlie Brown. And I understand, in fact, that this course is, or a version of it, is going to be available as a retirement learning course. Is that right?
Yes.
So look out for that. It'll be on the Nobel Prize winners in science. And I wouldn't mind being one of her graduate students, who have nothing but praise for her support as a mentor. One of her many science outreach programs has been kids and computers. Getting computers for kids and getting kids to come to work on Vanderbilt's computers. She's developed workshops for science teachers. She's worked with a Peabody Science Teacher in Residence program to start a summer camp for girls. She's guided the production of CD-ROMs dealing with immunology and neuroscience lessons for high school classrooms. And she's established a graduate teaching fellows program that puts graduate students into science classrooms. After all this, she won an NIH Science Education Partnership Grant that funds science curriculum development and broadcasting to local schools via video conferencing equipment. So you see we've got a lot of technical stuff here today. This is, Virginia's in her element with this kind of equipment. And then she got another grant from the National Science Foundation to promote science communication skills in the classroom. Well, science education may seem remote from many of our lives, and we often find ourselves in a cultural climate and a political climate that mistrusts science, especially when it tells us things that we don't want to hear. But the work of people like Jenny may now be starting to pay off, with recent announcements from the White House about new funding initiatives for science. What do we need in the 21st century? What should we be hoping for in this area? Well, if you want to find out, I think I better just turn over the floor to and welcome Professor Virginia Shepherd, who's director of our Science Outreach Program.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I'm always excited about talking about a subject that I'm really passionate about. And what I'd like to do today is to give you an overview of what's been happening out in the public in terms of reports and recommendations, and summarize some of those for you that actually go back to as early as 1983, and then go through a little bit briefly of things that we're doing at the Center for Science Outreach, and then end with some ways that we might think of continuing the reforms, making these nationwide, and then show a very, very short DVD movie that I think you'll enjoy that's about 2 minutes long. So let me get right into this. It is indeed the 21st century. And recently, our current U.S. Secretary of Education made the comment that the key to innovation, which has been the heart of our country's success, is creativity and problem solving. And I will repeat those words throughout my talk. And that is what is learned when students study math and science. In a less eloquent statement, she also said that a couple of weeks ago, the Winter Olympics may be cool, but math and science is hot. Now, why math and science? And that's obviously a question that we all need to consider, and I'm going to give you some points that were stressed in a 2000 report that's now called the Glenn Commission Report from the National Commission on Math and Science Teaching for the 21st Century. So, why math and science? First of all, we all know that there's a rapid change nationally and globally, and this demands math and science-related knowledge and abilities. And this is only going to increase as we head further into the 21st century. We all of us, need math and science for every decision we make in our everyday lives. As we take more control of our medical decisions, as we take more control of all decisions that affect our lives, we're going to need more math and science-based education. Math and science are linked to the nation's security interests, and this has been evident for decades now, and many very important discoveries have come out of these initiatives. And finally, something that I think is extremely important is that the deeper intrinsic value of math and science shapes and defines everything that we do, our common life, history, and culture. They're inextricably linked. Now, one of my mentors in this has been Bruce Alberts, who just stepped down as president of the National Academy of Science. And Bruce has been a champion of connecting scientists to classrooms to assist in increasing science literacy. And that's where I come in. As a scientist, I think it is our responsibility to help in that endeavor. And I have partnered, as David has said, for at least the last 15 years to work with teachers and students in the K-12 community. So Bruce made this comment several years ago that scientists and engineers working in partnership with local teachers represent an essential new force that will be required for effective science education reform. Another wonderful leader in this field is Rita Colwell, who just stepped down as the National Science Foundation director, and she made the statement that there is no group of people who should feel more responsible for science and math education in this nation than our scientists and scientists-to-be. So we have great leaders who are pronouncing this effort to connect scientists, and again, that's why I'm here. Now, back in 1983, as I mentioned, John Glenn, then a senator, headed up a commission to look at, this was the 2000 commission. In 1983, the then Secretary of Education put together a commission to look at education in our nation, and they produced a 36-page report that was called The Nation at Risk. And in this, they made several recommendations about education globally. Education requirements should be strengthened for what they at that time called the five new foundations of education: English, math, social studies, science, and computer science. They recommended that schools should adopt higher and measurable standards for academic performance. They recommended that the amount of time students spend engaged in learning should be significantly increased. Now, in fact, if you look at our schools, our students spend about 6 hours per day in the classroom and 180 days per year. In Europe and in Asia, most students spend 8 hours a day in the classroom and up to 220 days per year. So we're a little bit behind those countries. And the other recommendation was that the teaching profession should be strengthened. And you'll hear this theme throughout my remarks. Now, the John Glenn Commission. This was entitled Before It's Too Late, a very appropriate title. It was published in 2000. And in this publication, they were stressing predominantly to strengthen science education through promoting better teacher preparation and education programs. Their first goal was to establish an ongoing system to improve the quality of math and science teaching in grades K-12. The second goal was to increase the number of math and science teachers and improve the quality of their preparation. Goal three was to improve the working environment to attract more teachers to the profession and make it more attractive. Now, you may be aware of this. You probably have heard about some of these initiatives and recommendations in the press. But recently, a group of senators and other legislators, headed up by Lamar Alexander, was asked to put together a report in response to what was viewed as the national crisis in science education. And it was entitled Rising Above the Gathering Storm. And this has really created ripples throughout the science world at the level of higher education down through K-12. And the goal of this report was to really emphasize that we need to energize and employ America for a brighter economic future. The first recommendation of their three recommendations was K-12. We need to increase America's talent pool by vastly improving K-12 science and math education. So their first recommendation was K-12. Their second one was to sustain and strengthen the nation's commitment to basic research. So they want more dollars to support the basic research that goes on at all of our universities, such as Vanderbilt. And they want to make the U.S. the most attractive setting in which to study and perform research. Now, what this led to, I'm going to talk about one more giant in the science publication world, Time Magazine. And this was an issue of a few weeks ago, and it was the lead article was, Is America Flunking Science? Now, they gave a little more balanced view of where we stand in science education and where America stands globally. And the main point of the article was that the U.S. still leads the world in scientific innovation, but years of declining investment and as well as fresh competition from abroad threatened to end that supremacy. And what they pointed out was the following. Foreign investors have nearly caught up with us in terms of patents, and the U.S. has science publishing, a publication of our original research articles, has fallen behind at Europe's, and Asia's is surging. We still have the most science majors in the world, but if you adjust that for population, we rank 25th. The number of U.S. PhDs awarded in science is actually decreasing, while China's is again soaring. The U.S. leads in federal research dollars, but six countries now devote a larger percentage of their GDP to science. So where is this, is there really then a crisis? And I've pulled just a few statistics, and there are many more out there. I'm going to give you probably a little biased point of view since I am a scientist and I do believe there is a crisis. Shirley Tilghman, who is the president of Princeton, has called this the quiet crisis. But in fact, I think we do agree at this point that there is a crisis. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, fourth and eighth graders are kind of holding their own with respect to other countries, but 12th graders have been declining and continue to decline on test performance in science. 47% of our 12th graders perform below the basic level, with only two at the advanced level. The number of teachers teaching without certification or major in their field is estimated at 30 to 40%. Now, this little figure, and I like the test tube bar graph, shows Finland leading the pack in terms of countries with the highest percentage of 24-year-olds with science degrees at 13.2. I haven't listed all the countries above us. There are about 15. The U.S. is at the bottom with 5.7. There are countries, of course, below us, but we certainly are trailing some of the other important countries. And in the figure below this, I've shown a three-part figure with the box on the left showing the highest countries in terms of student performance on international tests. The middle block is the kind of average group, and that's where the U.S. is, and then the lower block. So we are not certainly at the top. How are we doing in Tennessee? We have a ways to go. Only 59% of high school students are taught by teachers with a major in their subject. Only 20% of high school students take at least one upper-level science course, 20%. 25% of 8th graders are at or above proficient. The national average is 42%. Less than 10% of our students score a 3 or better on AP exams compared to the national average of 22%. The graduation rate is also alarming. The national graduation rate has stayed pretty constant for the last 15 years at about 72%. the graduation rate in Tennessee has gone from 69% to 57%. So this is not science specific, but it does give you an overview of education. Now, what the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report generated was Protecting America's Competitive Edge Act. So there is now an act on the table called PACE, and there are several recommendations that I'm going to allude to in this talk. And basically, one of the recommendations is that we train 70,000 high school teachers to lead advanced placement courses in math and science, that we bring 30,000 math and science professionals to teaching classrooms. And this is what President Bush has been calling the adjunct teaching corps. 30,000 math and science professionals by the year 2015. And give early help to students who struggle with math. Now, what we've been doing is under the auspices of a center called the Vanderbilt University Center for Science Outreach. This was established in the summer of 2004, and we have actually been in operation and doing things, I myself and others, since about 1990. And our mission is to connect scientists to the K-12 community and the community at large to improve science literacy. So what have we been doing? I'm actually going to move to the next slide. We have three major areas of programs. And I call these scientists in the classroom programs, where we send scientists into classrooms in reality and virtually, and I'll talk about that. We have programs for teachers, where we bring teachers to campus for research opportunities, as well as host content workshops for teachers in the summers. We also have programs for students in the summer. We have summer camps that I'll talk about, and we also have a new research internship program for high school students that I probably won't say much about. So scientists in the classroom. I am probably the most passionate about this program. As I mentioned, in 1999, a program was established by Rita Colwell, who was then the director of the National Science Foundation. This first point just reemphasizes the goal from the PACE Act of having 30,000 professionals go into classrooms by the year 2015. But we need a training program. We can't simply send people like myself into classrooms. There needs to be some kind of training, partnership building workshop that I'll talk about in a minute. So in 1999, Rita Colwell established this program, which is known as the GK-12 program. G stands for graduate student, and K-12 is obvious. And what this does is send students, graduate students, into K-12 classrooms to work in partnership with classroom teachers. It's a wonderful program, yet you really have to see these partnerships in action to understand the value that goes on. Students are the science resource people for the teachers. The teachers feel comfortable to ask the student if they need help with a particular science concept. The students gain teaching experience and become comfortable asking the teacher for help with their teaching skills. So it's a win-win situation for everyone, with the students actually learning science and becoming excited about science and science careers. So this program has been going on for we're in our sixth year now. We are waiting anxiously to hear if we are going to get two more years of funding based on, it's called an accomplishment-based renewal. We are the only program that is being considered for that. We certainly hope we get that money. This is a partnership that includes Vanderbilt, Meharry Medical College, Tennessee State University, and the Metropolitan Schools, Nashville Schools. We have had 59 graduate students from all three of these institutions of higher education. We've had about 65 to 70 partner teachers, and we've been in 18 middle schools and about 5 high schools. We're focusing right now on middle schools, and this year we have 12 teaching fellows or graduate students working with 15 teachers. We cover all disciplines in the sciences, from engineering to mathematics. And the impacts from this program have been amazing. The K-12 students have shown increased performance on pre- and post-science tests. And probably the most exciting thing is that they've shown an increased enthusiasm and excitement about science. They don't want to be absent on the days that the graduate students are there, and discipline referrals have gone way down. They love these graduate students. For the K-12 teachers, they have self-reported that they have now spend more time in their classes on hands-on activities and inquiry-based learning. They also have self-reported that they feel that they have an increase in their content knowledge. So it's a great professional development program also. The fellows have gained enhanced communication and teaching skills, and as well as an increased understanding of the needs of K-12 classrooms. And that's been a wonderful outcome of this program. Now, the other way that we send students scientists into classrooms is through video conferencing. This is a relatively new technology, particularly for K-12 classrooms. It's been used a lot in business, in the corporate world, and also in community college and that network. But there are challenges with metro schools and with K-12 classrooms. We were funded originally in 1999 to begin this program, and we've really built up what I think is a wonderful example or model for other places in the country to use. This is an interactive way for a scientist to walk down to our office on the Vanderbilt campus. They sit down in front of a camera. They can connect immediately to 3 or 4 classrooms, so maybe 100 students, and it's interactive. The students can see the scientist, the scientists can see the student, and they can interact and have a dialogue. So students are constantly asking questions. I'll show you just a brief video here, if it's going to work.
Go ahead.
This is Arnie Heiser from Dyer Observatory with a class at USN.
Their size, is that a solid or do they stay in the gas?
So the student has asked a question.
It's very hot. I mean, we're still talking about temperatures in there of millions and millions of degrees, and therefore you can't get anything solid. Now, there may be some quasi-solid surface-like.
So the scientist who is speaking can see the student, and the student can see the scientist.
4,000 degrees,
and it's,
so that's still pretty hot. But nevertheless, you might get some...
It's a wonderful way to immediately and instantaneously connect this scientist, as I said, to several classrooms. What's more is it's brought in a lot more science volunteers because these people can now take out an hour in their day by simply walking down to our studio rather than having to drive to 4 different schools. We can also connect all over the country, all over the world. We've had over 150 conferences now in more than 300 sites. We're actually in more than 20 states, and we've interacted with many more than 10,000 participating students, and we've gone to 2 different countries, Canada, we've also been in, I say 2 countries, but in fact we've been in more. We've been in Iceland, we've been in Japan, we've been in Canada. So it crosses geographic boundaries as well. We've had over 90 Vanderbilt experts representing more than 20 departments and centers. And what the other nice thing about this is that we get faculty participating, medical students, graduate students, undergraduate students from all levels. And it's a wonderful program. We cover many topics. We've developed some topics in our own center, the CSO, but we cover genetics, neuroscience, toxicology, engineering, physics. We have a wonderful series at Dyer Observatory. So you can see that it's a great way to engage both scientists and students. Now, we also have developed a program that has gained national attention, which is called our Girls in Science Camp. And this is a 1-week non-resident camp for middle school girls. We've had over 600 participants to date. We, 2 years ago, started a boys camp, and we've had about 70 participants in that camp. The camp is held at Vanderbilt, also at Dyer Observatory in Radnor Lake. And it's also, the camp was selected as the prize in the Discovery Health Channel Young Scientist Contest. So they now have a Vanderbilt Camp Prize. And so every year, Discovery Health Channel sends a young woman and her parents for a week to Nashville to participate in this camp. And again, I'm going to show you, if I can here, a brief little video.
It's a simple experiment. Drop an egg from 20 feet, but protect it so it won't break.
The box around it is supposed to be like a skull, and the brain is the egg. And we're seeing how the skull protects the brain.
Some of the contraptions are outrageous, and they work.
I don't see any cracks.
Others look good, but the results are mixed and sometimes real messy.
Yeah, girls, be brave.
We have additional programs that you'll see if you have a handout. Another one that has been really exciting for both my husband and I to be involved in is Kids and Computers, which is a program where we bring fifth and sixth graders to campus from two community centers, Edge Hill Community and Preston Taylor Homes. And they work with undergraduate students to learn about, actually to be mentored and form associations with the undergraduates, but also to learn computer techniques. Now, the programs for teachers that we've had have been really exciting for me because I feel it's very important for me as a scientist to partner with the people who are really teaching the kids. I've learned an immense amount from the teachers that I've interacted with, and it's been a very important part of our center. Our goal in these programs has been to facilitate professional development for K-12 science teachers through research experiences, to build long-term collaborative relationships, and to enhance their science content. We've done content workshops, and this is kind of where I started in this, and probably did a not-so-good job when I first started, but I've learned a lot in 15 years. We also have teachers in residence who take either a part of their week or a whole year out to work in our center. We have a research experience for teachers program where they come in the summers and work in labs. We've done most of the Gateway Biology training for Middle Tennessee teachers, and we're now engaged in partnership with MNPS in a Summer Science Academy for content. Now, one little program that I want to mention quickly is a program I thought was wonderful and exemplifies how we can partner scientists and teachers. For four summers, we had medical students, undergraduate students, faculty working with K-12 teachers to develop CDs for use as enrichment tools in science classrooms. They basically built these CDs. They got all the content. They built in videos. They did original videos. And it was a wonderful professional development experience for the teachers in both science content and technology. Again, I've got a little video here.
Good morning. Biology class for these ninth graders is different today. They get to play a CD. It's ImmunoTV with channels on basic biology and immunology. The topics relate to the teenagers by starting with things they know, like the flu and chickenpox.
So they're different for each person.
Right. Mm. Many kids, I think, are turned off by science because they feel it's kind of too much for them. So we're going to try and show how very relevant it is to them and get them very interested.
Medical students like Chris Ambrose from the Community Scholars Program at Vanderbilt Medical Center helped develop the CD. All the topics use sound bites and video clips.
I was trying to take my clothes off because my body was getting hot and I could no longer see the people in front of me.
Let's go to Mount Calvary.
Okay.
That's really gross.
Material for the CD came from governmental agencies, private citizens, and even national television networks. The CD requires student response.
Now, what has the impact of all of these programs been? We have involved a lot of faculty and scientists in training, which is important to me, and that's been a challenge because, as you know, all of us have very large constraints on our time, and these scientists and students have been volunteers for the most part. We've had undergraduates as well and fellows. K-12 teachers, we've reached well over 1,000. It's probably many more than that now through our professional development programs. And the K-12 students, again, a very large number through all these programs. We hope that we can continue to reach many more of these, both teachers and students. Now, where do we go from here? Because, in fact, we do have a crisis. The programs that we're doing, is there anything there that is possibly a national model? I feel, for example, that the GK-12 program, where the graduate students are going into classrooms, could, in fact, form the core program for the government, for the nation, where scientists are being trained to work in partnership with teachers and could represent that adjunct teaching core. So I think we do, in fact, have one model program. The other model, I think, is that teacher institutes is a big area that they would like to expand on. And we have all the partners, all the resources, and a lot of experience in this area to dramatically expand the teacher institutes for science teachers that we do. There are other, you know, dreams that we have, actually. We are in the process of developing online courses that would be electives for class for high school students or middle school students, and we can do this through our video conferencing. We would love to develop and are, again, in the planning stages of developing web-based courses. This could be for both teachers and students. We would like to really to establish a national summer science institute for teachers, and we're working right now with the Exploratorium Institute in San Francisco to create the Exploratorium of the Southeast, which I'm really very excited about. I think it's possible that we could establish science academies within high schools. There's no reason that Stratford High School, for example, could not have a science academy where students would attend maybe a half a day or one day of each of their weeks and go to this science academy there, where they would get excellence in science. There could be expansion of all the science enrichment programs for middle and high school students. I think this is a key. We need to bring in more high school students into research labs at all of the universities in the city, and this needs to happen all across the country. Our summer science camps are easily replicatable and could be started and established at almost any university. As I mentioned, the GK-12 program could in fact be that training program for sending scientists into the classroom. And I would love to see something set up called the Vanderbilt University Science Center, where we would offer all of these activities under a single roof. Students and teachers alike could come and go, take courses, work in labs, learn what research means, and so forth. Now my favorite, is the Vanderbilt BioBus. We're in the library, we all know about the bookmobiles. I want to do a BioBus. Actually, several states are already doing this. This is not a new idea. But this could be a converted bus. This is what other states have done. And basically, you gut the bus and put in state-of-the-art laboratory and research equipment. And you can go to schools, you can go to rural areas, you could go to libraries, and you bring on students, middle school, high school students, or teachers to participate and to do hands-on activities and research experiments. So I would love to do a Vanderbilt BioBus. Now, I want to show a short 2.5-minute DVD as the end of the talk, and I then will, I guess, entertain questions.
Just leads to more questions. You'll always know. There's always so much more to know.
Learn to become problem solvers and critical thinking, and I think it's inherent in that discipline. So through discovery, through promoting creativity, through continual exploration, is where we're really going to develop those thinking skills. So I agree with you on one point, not necessarily philosophy, but because I think that science and technology are very important, but I think it's really the problem solving skills.
So when I think most people, when they think about science, probably think about that moment when they couldn't do the math in school. They got to a point when, you know, some part of algebra was just too difficult. And so they got turned off, quantitative thinking, by that little barrier in math. Now, if you take what you just said about problem solving, and you take the beautiful little video at the end, there was no mention of mathematics in there, and that awful problem when you just can't deal with these abstractions. I'm just wondering how much it's important to separate out the problem-solving and the creative aspects of science from those technical problems that obviously just destroy people's pleasure and willingness to pursue science.
Well,
is that something you kind of come across and have to deal with in science education?
I have not dealt with that directly, but because many people also become turned off by science, and as you get further in science, it's the science concepts also that tend to become inhibitory, I think. But math is really the language, if you will, of science, and understanding math, fundamentals of math, math concepts, I think you can go very far in science. There are certainly areas of science, if you want to get a PhD in theoretical physics, just to name one, you're going to need perhaps a little different math than you might need for my field, which is cell biology. But I think the basic fundamental math skills that you need to basically master will lead you where you need to go.
You're interested in K through 12. I'm kind of interested in the K end. And I'm just wondering, you know, whether a lot of people have said this, that you know, young children these days actually spend a lot of time in front of screens, indoors, not actually getting their hands dirty, not climbing trees, not looking under rocks and so on. And I'm wondering whether the problems of science education actually may start there. I mean, at this really early age when kids are really not being allowed to explore a complex, messy world. But
I tend to have a little bias there. I think that if you, I kind of break it off at around fourth grade. If you look at K-4 kids and you look at the continuum through those grades, there's a curiosity and a love of exploration and a lack of inhibition. These kids will ask you anything. If you ask a question, there'll be 15 hands in the air, all with goofy answers, but they're willing to answer. And then somehow that levels off through middle school, and we begin to turn kids off to science. And it may be the way we're teaching it. It may be our lack of excitement. It may be the lack of, being inhibited in teaching science, our confidence in teaching science. So I tend to think that kindergartners are the hope. I mean, we all need to stay kindergartners and have that excitement. I mean, we need to retain that.
Okay, one last question then. What would make the biggest difference in Tennessee? I mean, if you could get someone to do something, what would you... If you could, you know, like, write one letter and get the answer that you wanted from that letter, what would that letter be, and to whom would you write it?
Oh, that's a tough one. That's a really tough one. You know, we're not very high on we're below average on spending per pupil. We're below average on, I don't know this, but I don't think we pay our teachers enough. I really think that, there's teachers here. I guess I would say that we need to hold up the teaching profession as one of the greatest and most important professions that we have in this country. And somehow we have another.
Well, we're going to start just, Professor Shepard's going to take your questions and just write them down on a piece of paper. And then when we've got too many for her, we'll stop.
Okay.
I got one.
Okay, we'll start with the mic here and then this lady over here.
Okay, thinking about your grim statistics at the beginning of your presentation, were all schools included, including these cosseted private schools where everything's supposed to be better?
Okay, thank you. This gentleman?
If we look at a guy like Deming, and probably not 10 people in this room know who Deming was, and they have monuments to him in Japan. And he moved Japan, he blew Japan right past the U.S. in quality reliability. What can we do at the top of corporations and government to make people like Deming heard?
Thank you. The lady over here. And then.
Are your programs for your professional development programs for teachers and your summer camps open to people in other states, or are they just for Tennessee residents?
Thank you. Is the lady at the back there?
What has been the effect of the push for creationism and or intelligent design on your science program in education?
Okay.
My question was essentially the same thing. As a biologist, I've been extremely concerned about the push towards intelligent design education in the schools, under the guise of critical thinking, when in fact it doesn't fall under critical thinking. And the other point I wanted to ask about was, in my cohort in graduate school in ecology, many of the PhDs, there was basically a glut of PhDs, and there weren't enough research jobs. Most of the people ended up on soft money their entire careers.
Thank you. The gentleman back there.
Similar question. What conflict do you see, if any, between the administration's push to enhance science education and what many would perceive as a hostility towards science on the part of the current administration? And a small second question, do you have any kind of family science camps for parents and their kids?
There's a question, just this lady there, and then the gentleman there, lady there, okay. Lady on my right here first.
My observation as having been a high school science teacher and a mother is that an awful lot of kids are turned off on science and math in the early grades. I think we need to do a better job in educating our early education people in what in substance to teach instead of just how to teach. In one case, one of my sons came home and didn't understand math, and I found out the reason he didn't understand it was his teacher didn't understand it either.
Yes.
My daughter-in-law is a kindergarten teacher in Haywood County, which is one of the counties in Tennessee that's in crisis, and I would love to find out how she could get involved with this.
Thank you. That lady at the back there.
Yes, thank you. Given that there are lots of ways to teach creativity and critical thinking, and I work in aesthetic education, so I come to that, to this issue from that side, is the fear that we are not ranked nationally based on a concern that what is learned globally will not be shared? In other words, is the concern about ranking really an expression of nationalism?
Being one of scientific training and background experience, along with two or three of my friends who are in this room right now with the same sort of background, what's the opportunity for volunteers to assist? Not only teachers, but volunteers that might be able to help in this. I would think that you would need them. Now, in your presentation, I did not sense that there was anything yet going on with the early grades, that it really began with the middle school and the high school age students. Is it premature or is it in the planning stages? Thank you.
We have time maybe just for one or two more questions. Okay.
I loved your, we should all stay kindergarteners. I just love that idea. 40 to 45% of the population are kinesthetic, tactile, music, or art learners rather than the kind of people that like to sit and watch lectures like this one. And we see so much in middle school and high school. And we're losing a lot of these kids. And I wonder how we could use kinesthetic and tactile learning to help in bringing more kids into science.
Great. Any one more question, perhaps? Well, we got a lady here, and that will just round us off nicely. You're going to have to shout. Oh, there's a...
Other than a passion for science and education, what would attract a graduate student to be in this program? How are they compensated? Are they paid like teachers, or are they in school? Are they continuing their education? Just what right. would attract the graduate student to do this?
I think we're going to hand it back to you. We've got about 6 minutes.
6 minutes, all right. I'm going to race through this. I'm going to go from end to the beginning. So if I missed your question, just, I'm sorry. graduate students are, in fact, paid a small stipend. Actually, the NSF supports large stipends. And as we've moved into our program to sustain it, we're talking about this GK-12 program where we're putting graduate students into classrooms. We're talking with the business community, we're talking with our partnering institutions, we're talking with metro schools. We would like to build a huge adjunct teaching corps by providing small, what we call topping off stipends for the graduate students. And we would move to one day a week in the classroom. But that day with the kids and with the teacher will make a huge difference. So it's a small stipend, but we have a lot of partners looking for more. For those people who like to do, who like to get involved in learning that actually involves them, that's where we're headed, that's where we have to head in science. As researchers, that's what we do. We do science. And oftentimes, you'll go into a high school classroom and you'll listen to a lecture. And in fact, that can turn you off, like maybe my lecture did today, I don't know. But in fact, science is doing. And when you do a hands-on activity, that really catches the attention and the interest of all, of kids and adults of all ages. And so teachers, parents, everyone, we have to move to understanding that science is a doing field and do it that way. Early grades. We have focused primarily on middle to high school, and only because it's easier for scientists to go in maybe and talk to high school students than it is to go in and talk to kindergartners. Now, having said that, I visited a K-6 school this past week, and it was wonderful. And I would love to get, and we will get much more involved in K-6, and we actually have somebody on my staff who is very interested in this. But as I said, you know, kids at this age are so wonderfully inquisitive. And we listened to a little girl explaining what to do when she called 911, and it was very fun. Volunteer opportunities. We're always looking for volunteers, anywhere from going into classrooms, if that's what you want to do, to being an email partner to a student. We have an Ask a Scientist program, and we have to figure out the mechanism for that. But I could leave a yellow pad up here for people to sign up. But you also have our handout, and you can simply email us if you really would like to volunteer. There are many people in the community, retired people, practicing scientists, educators, parents, any of you who would like to volunteer, we can find a place for you. Trust me. Let me hit a tough one. Intelligent design and creationism. I personally agree that intelligent design should not be taught as a science or in a science classroom. I will tell you that the Smithsonian has designated there are four or five areas that it's going to put its resources in over the next several years, and all of those have to do with evolution of some sort. And I would love to sponsor at Vanderbilt a Smithsonian series that would focus on those topics. So we have not found really any problem with the programs that we've been doing, but it is a big issue and it needs to be addressed. And I think teachers need to have some guidance from universities, from other places, in how to deal with that issue. What else have I done? Have written down here. It's an interesting question about the hostility for science and also now creating dollars for science. I think it's really finally hit that we are in a global community. And I don't know how many of you have read the bestseller, The World is Flat, but it is very evident that the world is flattening and that much of what we used to do in our country is now being outsourced. And it is no longer simply America and the other countries. It is a global community. And I think that I believe that our leaders have finally recognized that, and we need to increase our understanding in the areas of science and technology innovation to compete nationally and globally. Family camp, I love it. That's a great idea. We don't have anything like that. We're constantly being urged by national funding agencies to include parents and families, so I'll take that suggestion. Something that we struggle with, a question was that there weren't enough jobs for the PhDs that we're producing. And in some areas that's not true, in some areas it is true. In my field there are probably too many PhDs. I personally think, and I'll get back up on my soapbox a little here and say that I think we're not exposing our PhD students to all the possible careers that are out there. So we produce, at Vanderbilt University, we produce about 90 PhDs in biomedical sciences every year. Not all 90 of those PhD students are going to go off to Harvard or to Princeton or to Vanderbilt to fill faculty positions. So we need to be much smarter about introducing students to optional alternative careers. I think a wonderful career, for example, is science communication, which is a new major at Vanderbilt. And we have to, and scientists can be great promoters and communicators of science. So there are careers out there. I think we have to be smarter about promoting those.
One more minute.
Okay. Let's see. Our programs are, in fact, open to other states. We had a group of teachers from Singapore for 2 years. They paid all their expenses and came to our professional development workshops. It was wonderful. We would love to go to Singapore and see what they're doing. We've had, in our girls' camp, we've had girls from all over the country. They may have a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a friend. We have arranged housing, although we don't like to do that. But they can be national. We are going to ramp up in our teacher professional development programs to make them national. I've already talked about the person who had a daughter, I think, teaching kindergarten, and we're going to look for ways to really move down through the grades, because that's really exciting. And in fact, again, a little bit of my preaching, you really find in K-8 is the area where teachers are uncomfortable teaching science predominantly. And you have huge numbers of teachers who are certified for elementary who find themselves suddenly teaching physical sciences, and they may never have taught that before. So I think programs for them are even especially important.
Well, before we thank our speaker, I'd like just to tell you that next month, we have the dean of our law school, Ed Rubin, who's going to talk to us about sex, morality, and the law. But, and so come back if there's any one of those.